Blog Talk Radio.
It's time. You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation, brought to you by Cal Nez Design and hosted by Cal Nez himself.
Yate, this is Marley Shabala with Politics on the Navajo Nation. I'm going to introduce myself in the way that I was taught in the Navajo way. Marley Shabala Yinshia, Toye Glinia Shlo, Najd Eja Bashishtin. And I'm going to be the host from here on for Politics on the Navajo Nation. The usual host, Cal Nez, is a presidential candidate for the Navajo Nation. And he decided that he would like to have me be the host for Navajo for Politics on the Navajo Nation. And I certainly appreciate that, folks, because he realized that he did not want to use Politics on the Navajo Nation to promote his campaign. I wish that could be said of Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley and any of the other elected officials who are in their positions currently and are running for Navajo Nation Council Delegate or even, you know, the election supervisors, Navajo Nation election supervisors, townships, any of the elected positions that are open. And tonight I'm going to also be introducing a longtime colleague. Her name is Sharon Mays. And she was a former news reporter, radio personality, for several radio stations in Gallup, New Mexico. And here she is, and I'd like her to introduce herself.
Yate, everyone. My name is Sharon Mays, and I just would like to say hello to all our listeners. It's very wonderful to be with you tonight.
Yeah, and Sharon is going to be also helping to with the callers, and so she'll be letting you know who is on the line with us tonight, and we invite all of the callers to try and okay. All righty, let's see. I don't know what that was. I think that was
an oil driller.
Okay, be quiet back there while you're drilling oil then. Well, I guess I should ask I heard from some friends and also was all over social media about a question that was asked of Navajo President Ben Shelley during the last presidential forum. And he was asked, what was fracking? And he I don't know if he misheard or he didn't understand, but he thought that the reporter who was asking him about to explain fracking, he thought she was saying fractions. So that was pretty interesting, considering that most of the Eastern Navajo Agency is under oil and gas development. Right, Chair?
Yes. Was he being coy, or did he dishonestly not hear what they said?
You know, I hadn't had a chance to look at the video that was taken of that presidential forum. But from what I understand, there was some issues regarding that he just didn't know how to answer the question, so he didn't answer it. So if he didn't answer it, then he didn't know the answer.
Well, that's interesting because that is one of the greatest concerns that we have now. Just as you mentioned, like in Eastern Agency, I just recently saw a petition in reference to, you know, a fracking effort that is going to be started near Chaco Canyon, of all places. And there, at last count, there was like 25,000 people who were signing that petition to prevent that from happening. It was a petition to the BLM. And, I mean, you know, frack, you just start the word frack. It seems like, you know, it would be a good guess that, you know, they would be talking about fracking.
Well, the issue of the oil and gas industry and fracking is not just an issue that is here on the Navajo Reservation. It's also a global issue. And a lot of our indigenous relatives to the north and across the ocean have been dealing with fracking, and they have pretty much unified with one voice to say that they opposed it, because that type of industry or that method of extracting oil and gas has a huge impact on water. It contaminates a huge amount of water.
Well, just like in Kentucky and also other places back east that we've been seeing on the news, how they're able to light their faucets. I mean, literally, you know, light them on fire. You know, and they are in areas where fracking is going on. It is so dangerous. And as you mentioned with the indigenous people, they up north particularly, they are trying to instill in everybody how important this is, because water is life. That is what they keep saying over and over again, that this is something that we cannot do because it will damage, you know, the aquifers, the water supplies. And we need to think of our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren.
Well, the issue with the fracking here on the Navajo Nation is that so far I haven't seen any kind of environmental impact statements, environmental impact assessments that have been done in the Eastern Agency. And so I'm wondering where they are, and that's under the federal government. But then again, we have our Navajo Environmental Protection Agency. We also have our Navajo Nation Division of Natural Resources, which is where, you know, there should be some type of protection, education for the people to let them make a very, you know, a well knowledgeable, educated decision on whether or not they want to have oil and gas and fracking on their lands. Don't you think that would be fair?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that so many people are unaware that fracking is going on here on, you know, Navajo land. And, you know, looking at a map and seeing the different areas, particularly where you were talking about an Eastern Agency, I myself didn't know it was that much was going on. And even up in, you know, the Northwestern Regency of the Navajo Nation, fracking is going on up there. So it's being done in a way that we're not noticing it so much.
Well, I drove through the, I was driving from Albuquerque to Farmington, and on my way, I started noticing a huge amount of trucks and all kind of petroleum that was happening. And you could see the flaring from the pipes, from the gas line, gas, you know, where they were out there doing their fracking. And that's one thing I think that's an issue is the flaring of the excess gas and the smell. You could smell it from the road. And I was probably about maybe 3 miles from where they were doing the flaring, but there's a huge amount of activity out there. If you drove from, it would probably be around, as you're getting close to Aztec and just past the Hickory Apache Casino.
How many of the candidates are really talking about, you know, the issue of protecting Mother Earth? I know that I've seen references to this in Dwayne Yazzie's campaign. I saw a mention of it with Russell Begay, Cal Nez, Carrie Martin. I'm trying to think of who else we've... that seems to be such an important issue for so many people and so many Navajo people that they want to know what their candidates are going to do. And especially, like, you know, the concern about the proposal of the uranium, you know, and extracting that. And, you know, where do those candidates stand on these issues? The Navajo people want to know.
You know, it would be interesting if we could gather up all of their written materials, their campaign information, and I know that there are some groups out there, young Navajos, that are putting together how the council has been voting, what the president has been making statements about, and so they're doing a good analysis of that. And if any of them are out there listening, you know, please send your information on over or post it on Politics on the Navajo Nation. There are also some questions on Politics on the Navajo Nation Facebook, and they also were, you know, some of the voters and people were asking for the voter records of council delegates, and that would be great to see. I'm hoping that perhaps I want to make a request to the legislative branch to produce, you know, the last 4 years of the council records of voting. But what you can't find, though, is how the council delegates voted while they were in committee. They raised their hands, and so there's just no record of how they voted.
You know, I think that your point's well taken that, you know, folks want to know, and oftentimes Navajo people don't realize that this is public information. It's okay for them to ask for them. You know, it's okay for them to insist on seeing that council delegate's record. They are public servants. You know, they are not royalty. They are not, you know, kings or queens. We're allowed as Navajo voters to question them and to insist on knowing how they vote on these important issues.
The talking about the voting record and also the public servants and their activities, the Navajo Nation Council's top committee, the Navajo Iatik Committee, is having a meeting on Friday, and they're going to be meeting with, well, they're going to be hearing a report from the Save the Confluence families. And the last time that the Save the Confluence families had asked to deliver a report to the council, they weren't able to. I can't remember if it was because they lost a quorum or they didn't get a quorum. But I saw a press release from Save the Confluence, and they also announced that the Escalade project, which is the developers of the proposed Confluence project, will also be there making their presentation. And so I thought that was very fair of them to issue their press release saying that they were going to be presenting to the committee, and then to also say that the, you know, the opposition will be there. So that should be interesting. But we're coming up on 7:15, and I wanted the listeners to know that Farmington Daily Times news reporter Noelle Smith is going to be joining us, and she's going to be giving us a wrap-up of what's happening out in her area of news coverage, which is the Shiprock, the Northern Agency. So why don't we bring her on? Hello, Noelle, you there? Hello? Noelle?
Hello.
Hi, Noelle.
Hi.
Glad you could come and be on air tonight. So this is Noelle Smith, and she's going to be giving us some news from her area, talking about a couple of stories that she worked on. And I'm going to leave it up to you to let our listeners know what you're going to be talking about, and then just go ahead and share that news for us, would you please? Thank you.
Hi, this is Noelle Smith from the Farmington Daily Times.
going to talk about some stories I worked on for the past week's issue, starting with stories about some of the local farmers markets that have started or are in progress. And the first one I wrote about is started by a nonprofit group called Rio Perco Alliance and a Navajo group. Pardon me if I pronounced the name wrong, but it's Haspiditwo, I think. But they have this unique project going on to bring some a mobile farmers market to three of the Eastern Agency chapters. So we're looking at taking that mobile unit to Counselor, Ojo, Encino, and Torreon chapters. And so this past Saturday on the 7th, they had an opening celebration at Ojo, Encino chapter. And I spoke to the executive director of Rio Perco Alliance, and her name is Barbara Johnson. And she said the reason why they want to do this is to make sure that everyone gets access to fresh fruits and vegetables each week. So they're looking at taking this mobile unit and starting service after June 14th, and there are three different chapters. So, like, maybe Monday it'll be in Ojo and Encino, and Tuesday in Torreon, and Wednesday in Counselor. And they think this is one way to help combat the high number of diabetes cases that are in those areas. And also those areas have been labeled as a food desert by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And a food desert is an urban neighborhood or rural town that lacks access to fresh, healthy, and affordable food. And often these communities may also lack access to supermarkets or grocery stores and may be only served by fast food restaurants and convenience stores. And in the case of these chapters, residents usually are looking at traveling like more than 50 miles one way to shop at a grocery store, and maybe they'll go to Farmington or Rio Rancho or Albuquerque. And I think the nearest community to them is Cuba, but Cuba is also probably limited in what they can offer. So Johnson said that another thing that they want to do with this is also try to get the local residents to think about returning to traditional farming. And even if it's just a simple backyard garden, have them return to, you know, growing their own fruits and vegetables. And if they're already doing that, the group wants to help those residents maybe take them a step in increasing the size of their garden, or even looking at different resources to use to try to improve the growth cycle. And right now, at the time I interviewed her last week, she said there are at least like six farmers in the area that expressed interest in participating. But she's also heard from other interested parties, including members of the Cuba Farmers Market, and they would be selling their produce through the mobile farmers market. So that's one story I worked on. And
oh, you know what, Noelle? Before you start the other story, what intrigued me was the term of food desert. You know, because people think of the Navajo Reservation as a desert in itself, but that's new terminology.
Right. I had to have Barbara explain to me what is a food desert, because I said that Navajo Nation is a desert itself, but I said, well, what is a food desert? And she said, well, these are places that are rurally located. They're not, you know, near a highway or even a major town or city. They're just there in the, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And residents have to travel, you know, great distance to supplies. And then also she said another thing, too, that affects residents is some homes don't have electricity or running water, so if they don't have electricity, they can't have a refrigerator, so how do they keep their food fresh? So a lot of times they're relying on canned or dry goods, and that you can eat that so much, and, you know, it starts impacting your diet, but
And they're always saying, eat something fresh. So I had to learn about the what food deserts mean. And I was like, yeah, that describes a good chunk of the Navajo Nation as far as where people live and these where the chapters are located, which are, you know, not near major communities or major cities.
Well, I wonder if, you know, the chapters, they're somewhat centrally located in some communities, and I know that around the Loop area that they have community farms. Is that part of this also, what they're doing, this kind of project?
Spending that far, but they're looking at that too. I don't think like making a community farm like centrally at the chapter, but more trying to get people to grow their own vegetables. Like I think similarly, like during World War II, what some families did, they had victory gardens, and that's because the United States was involved in that conflict, and a lot of the goods that were being produced were being shipped overseas to support the troop effort, and they were told to conserve at that time, and I think that's what this group is trying to get people to do too. I mean, I think they want them to think outside of the box rather than thinking they have to travel the distance to get what they could grow in their own backyards. So they want to do these presentations and get people to thinking that they can do it. It's not something that's impossible. There is a possibility of doing it, and here are some of the resources to get you started, and here are the ways to do it, and that's what they want to promote. And even if it's just growing like cucumbers or spinaches or lettuce, that's a start, and then maybe from there build upon it and share those grow with your family or with relatives or even other community members. Maybe if you need to make a few bucks, sell it to them too. And they're trying to restart something, get people to think of those different ways of living, which is I think traditionally our way of life, but it's kind of returning to it rather than running from it.
Well, you know what? I like that word you're using, which is restart, and that's what it is. It's our way of life, the Navajo way of life. That's how we existed before our non-indigenous relatives came here. We were very self-sufficient. We grew all of our food. So the land here, our homeland, is capable of reproducing all and any types of foods. And I was listening to a program, and they were talking about, they had a specific name for certain foods. And the indigenous woman who was talking about these foods, she was saying, she made a comparison. She said, how people talk about yogurt and how you get certain nutrients from that. She said, well, as Native people, we didn't eat yogurt over here before the Europeans came. But in place of it, she said, is chili. She said chili is equal to eating yogurt. And I thought that was interesting, and our people should have this type of food history. So I really was happy to see your article about the farmers market. I posted it on my Facebook, and it got several shares, and I took out that portion of it that where you announced where all the farmer markets were going to be at, because I see a few people right now that are selling along the roadsides, and they do sell. They're selling cherries, and some of them are selling the traditional food, the kneel-down bread, which is from the corn. And so, there's always these little out-of-the-way farmers markets, I think, that we've always had here on the reservation. And you know that during the tribal fair, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Right. And another thing that this promotes, too, is communication. As I was writing the story, I wanted to solely focus on this group effort, and my editor suggested, well, why don't you look at the other farmer markets in the area, because, Farmington,
Bloomfield, Chiprock, Aztec, they have that history of growing and farming in their background. So what happened was I got a hold of this local farmer named David Elder, and he calls it a garden, but it's like 3 acres that he's growing vegetables on. So he grows like different varieties of cucumbers, different varieties of peppers, different varieties of squash. And he was telling me what he likes about participating in the Farmington Growers Market and the Aztec Farmers Market is the interaction. He already has the love of farming in him. His grandparents were farmers, his parents were farmers, and now he's continuing that tradition. But he likes that customers can ask him questions about the methods he's using to grow his produce. And he said, it's good to know where your food's coming from when you go to a grocery store. You can't, find the farmer, because chances are the farmers out of your region could be in California, could be in the Midwest. But if it's a local grower, you can ask them, what kind of, do you use any type of pesticide? Do you use any type of, chemicals or anything to help, help the plant grow faster? Or is it all natural? How often are you watering them? What kind of soil does it grow in? Those are the questions he enjoys getting from his customers, because he can explain to them. And he told me it's all natural. He started his garden late the season because he knew there was going to be a late frost. And he said, some people started earlier and their plants were bigger, but his were just like maybe 6 inches high. But he said, once it starts growing, it's going to, flourish, and he'll have all his produce ready for people to buy at the two markets. So, even that part of the story was fun. Besides addressing the issue of getting people to eat healthier and buying locally, it provides an opportunity to learn where your food's coming from. What are you serving your children? What are you serving your extended relatives? And I think that's important to know. And it made me think how I myself go shopping, and I got excited, and I thought, well, I'm gonna, head to the farmers markets at some point this summer and see what I can find. And the varieties he offers too are not what you can find in the grocery store, which makes it a little bit extra special too.
I really like that. That is something that we're, as news reporters, we receive a lot of information. We are blessed to meet a lot of people, and they just talk our ears off, and they have great information. They're wonderful people, and so that's really great to hear. I'm going to give out our call-in number for our listeners out there, if you'd like to call in and comment about, Noelle's story, about the elections, whatever you'd like to comment on. And the number to call is 347-989-0048. That number again is 347-989-0048. And we're going to take a little break here before we hear the next story from Noelle Smith, news reporter at the Farmington, New Mexico Daily Times.
Dr. A. This is Marley Shabala with Politics on the Navajo Nation. And our call-in number, if you'd like to call in, is 347-989-0048. The number again is 347-989-0048. And this evening's show has, we're getting some news reports from up north here in Farmington, New Mexico, and I'm going to bring back Farmington Daily Times news reporter Noelle Smith. She's going to give us her second story that she had. And if I'm right, I think it's going to be about the late Navajo post author. And I'm going to go ahead and let Noelle tell us about
that. Hi, thanks for having me back. So yesterday I traveled from Farmington, a photographer whose name is John Austria, and I went from Farmington to Albuquerque yesterday morning to attend the funeral mass for the late Navajo coat talker Chester Nez. And the funeral mass was held at the Our Lady of Fatima Catholic Church on Lomas. And it was a nice service. It was presided by over by Father. I just forgot his name. Zorars, yeah. So there was a good turnout. I would say maybe about 500 friends, family, veterans, and family members. Community members who wanted to come out and just pay their respects. And from there, we also traveled to Santa Fe National Cemetery, where Chester Nez was finally laid to rest. And the cemetery is one that's operated by the U.S. Veterans Affairs. And there they did the 21 gun salute and the playing of taps, and Navajo Marine Staff Sergeant Kyle Lewis, who incidentally started working here in Farmington this past week as a recruiter, had the honor of presenting the flag to Michael Nez, who was Chester's son and was taking care of Chester for a number of years. So I asked Mr. Lewis how it felt to have that honor of presenting the flag to Michael, and also, you know, being Navajo, giving it to a family of a Navajo co-talker. And Mr. Lewis said that it was quite an honor, and he enlisted in the Marines about 11 years ago, straight out of high school after graduating from Coconino High and Flagstaff. And he said that he grew up in Flagstaff, but his family's originally from Dalcon, and he grew up knowing about the Navajo Code Talkers and seeing how they are honored and treated on the Navajo Nation. And when he got into the Marines, he realized the scope of how important the Code Talkers are and how they are appreciated. And so he said that it was a very great honor to be able to do that part of the service. And it was a very, very somber affair, which, you know, to be expected. But it was interesting to cover, and also enjoyable, I guess, to a certain extent, as a reporter, to watch how a funeral mass is performed and are officiated in the ceremonious part of the burial service, you know, the presenting of the flag, the playing of taps, and the 21 gun salute, and from there.
Noelle?
What?
Yeah, this is Sharon Mays. I was just marveling at, you know, for so long, so many people didn't know about the Code Talkers, and how that has changed so dramatically within the last 10 years, wouldn't you say?
Yes,
that worldwide,
yes.
More and more people now know about them and what the service, you know, that the incredible bravery and the service that, you know, they did on behalf of the Navajo Nation and on behalf of the United States?
Yes, I think with this, I think with the news of Chester's death broke, you saw how the coverage came nationally. You had like now National Public Radio, NBC News, CBS, I think the big three networks, you know, all air the story. I mean, even to this day when I go on Twitter and I put in Navajo, people are still tweeting these stories about Chester's passing, and I don't know if it's because he's the last of the original 29 or people are, you know, are understanding the place in history that the Navajo Code Talkers have, but at his funeral yesterday, I noticed, you know, there were people coming out that didn't necessarily know him, but they knew of the service they provided. And I've overheard a couple of Angle ladies standing by me, and they're like, they mentioned it. They're like, I came out because he was a code talker, and these guys are important, and we should be here in this moment to wish him farewell as he starts, you know, this other journey. And I thought that was pretty cool. I mean,
that's very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It was heartfelt. I mean, and he had the Patriot Honor Guard came out and they escorted. They were there in the church outside with holding these flags, and it was for veterans of all different branches of service during peacetime, during wartime. Even young members were there. They escorted, you know, his body from Albuquerque to Santa Fe on their, you know, following his casket with the motorcycles, and they were there at the burial too, and they were keeping an eye over the family and over the friends and even just members of the general public, and it was very beautiful to see.
That's so wonderful. With Mr. Nez's passing, it just brought back so many memories of here in Window Rock during the decade of the 1990s, when we were so blessed and lucky to be able to see so many code talkers at the local cafe where they used to hang out and just being, you know, having that chance to meet them and talk with them and oftentimes sitting there, you know, there the many tourists that would come through during the summertime, so many of them had grandfathers and fathers who also served in World War II. So, you know, the code talkers, when they were at the local cafe, they always wore their very distinctive clothing. So there was no doubt who they were. And it was very touching to see people from all over the world go up to them and want to shake their hand and just to talk to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I saw that at the service yesterday. There were at least 7 or 8 code talkers who attended, and after the funeral mass and also the burial service, people were going up to them, shaking their hands, taking photos. You know, the book that Chester co-wrote was being passed around because they wanted them to sign it, and I thought that was pretty cool because, you know, I think for a lot of people, this might be the only chance that they get to interact with them. And so they were, you know, they were seizing the day, as the quote goes. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And, you know, even just to go up to say thank you for your service, which you know, is something people ought to do to a veteran every time, you know, when they come across them. It was really nice.
You know, and on that note, you know, and of course, never trying to take away anything from the code talkers, it you know, and just as we've mentioned, you know, so many more people know about them. What I would like very much to happen is, you know, to have that same recognition and that same acknowledgement for our Vietnam veterans and also for our Korean veterans. And, you know, they're all getting older, and, you know, some of them were in very significant battles during the Vietnam War and in Korea. And, you know, because it was not, you know, the same situation as with the code talkers where they were, you know, specifically for that mission of creating that code, oftentimes the other veterans, you know, their service kind of gets kind of lost in the wayside because we don't know all those stories yet. And that's kind of what I'm hoping, too, is that as time goes on, that these veterans will also be acknowledged and we will hear more of their story.
Mm-hmm. I think that's going to come around as they grow older. I think that, I think it's just a big part of our human nature that we're, as people grow older, we realize how fragile life is getting, and so we want to get curiouser and curiouser, and a lot of our Korean veterans are starting to get in their 80s. Like my grandfather, he served in Korea, and he turned, I think, 81. So I was thinking that the other day, plus he's starting to develop Parkinson's. So I know now is the time to, you know, sit down and start talking to him, asking these questions, and see if he's comfortable in answering. And I'm sure he will be, because he wants that part of his life story to be told for the future generations. And I think that's going to happen. We're going to all start thinking about the other veterans that are getting older, and especially, you know, the Korean ones, because that war is not always recognized. And then I think from there it's going to go to the Vietnam veterans, too, to tell their stories of how, what they experienced, both, you know, in battle and also coming home, and how they were treated. I think that is a good point, you know, that we should be out there collecting the stories, and that's why, you know, we're in the business that we're in, because we're curious about it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think about major battles in Vietnam, like, you know, the Tet Offensive and Hamburger Hill, and then, like, in Korea, Pork Chop Hill. Those were major battles, and there were Navajos in those battles. So, you know, I'm just, like, hungry to hear their stories. I really want, you know, them to get, you know, that recognition for the things that they did, and how many, you know, were in smaller battles, but yet, you know, they still, you know, they were major military maneuvers that you know, had to be done.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This is Marley. And I just wanted to add to the conversation the, again, not to take away from the passing of Navajo Coast Hopper. In fact, there was a Navajo Coast Hopper that passed away on Sunday. He was from around the middle of the Navajo Reservation area. And his name was Navajo Coast Hopper Bidoni. And there were, you know, the flags were blown at half mast because of his passing. But one thing that I wanted to talk about, too, was that in recent, just, you know, it seems like more and more as I'm looking at major newspapers, there's been a lot of coverage of what's been happening with the Veterans Administration Hospital, especially the one down here in Arizona, well, down in the Phoenix area, southern Arizona. And there have been reports of a number of veterans that have passed on waiting to see a doctor. And I know that there was even a report that was given to one of the Navajo Council committees where a co-talker was actually evicted from their home by Navajo Housing Authority, that there are other veterans that have been waiting for years for their homes, and they passed away waiting. And the council has talked a lot about the homes for veterans and Navajo Housing Authority. But in my coverage of the Navajo Council and its committees, since the news broke about the VA hospital, I haven't heard anything from President Shelley. I haven't heard anything from the Navajo Nation Council. I haven't heard anything from the Oversight Committee, which is the Health, Education, and Human Services Committee, talking about how many Navajo veterans or Native veterans were treated the way that were treated in a way where they had to wait months to see a doctor. And this is in Arizona. I know of veterans who travel down there regularly, and they come back, and they say they have to wait for another appointment. And they wait, their appointments are 2 months in between. And now we understand why. And I think that a lot of the families that have to drive their veteran down there, or the veterans that have to gather a little bit of funding together to get down to the VA hospital, understand this. And I've heard it for the past 28 years as a news reporter here on the Navajo Reservation. It's not something new for a veteran, and I just wanted to add that to the conversation also. Mr. Nez, the late Navajo Code Talker Nez, he was able to, you know, be in a metropolitan area, and he used his experiences and his skills to help other veterans, and these, and I want to recognize those veterans that also reach out and help other veterans. And I'd like to just, you know, let our, if they have any veterans that are out there and would like to call in, please call in at 347-989-0048. Or even if you are a family member of veterans and would like to comment, the number again is 347-989-0048. And, well, do you have any other news stories or anything else you'd like to share with us?
Let's see. Oh, I wanted to add to your comment about the VA situation. I was wondering that too. As I read the stories, I wonder like what our Navajo veterans think about the situation. Because when I used to cover the district standing committees of the Navajo Nation Council, I would hear veterans say, you know, why can't we get a VA facility or a clinic established on Navajo so we don't have to travel to Prescott, Arizona? We don't have to travel to Phoenix. We don't have to travel to Albuquerque. And I know that was a topic of discussion for a while there of how do we get a clinic on Navajo that the Navajo veterans who reside on Navajo Nation can go to, so they don't have to, you know, scrounge around for gas money, or they don't have to borrow somebody's vehicle to go to an appointment. And I wonder too what does the government officials think about this whole waiting list scandal, I guess you could say. And I haven't heard anything about it from them either. But that's a good topic you brought up, Marley. Another story I tackled this week was this announcement from the Navajo Nation Judicial Branch that the case that Navajo Nation Council Speaker Johnny Nays filed against 12 council delegates and an employee of the legislative branch, he had, I think it was in April, he had asked for a temporary restraining order and a preliminary hearing because he was I guess you could say challenging the paid administrative leave that he was put on. He said that it wasn't justifiable. So he, in the course of the case being in the Window Rock District Court, he, through his lawyer, asked for it to be moved to peacemaking so the parties could come together and talk about it and come up with a resolution to the matter. And they had until, my understanding is, May 31st to get a hold of the peacemaking program and arrange a time to meet. And that deadline passed, and out of the 13 people involved in the case, only 5 of them contacted the peacemaking program, and 2 agreed to peacemaking, but that it had to be all parties involved, so you're looking at 14 people, you know, getting together, and I'm sure with their legal representatives there too. But so now the matter's going back to the district court, and so I wrote about that, and that's the latest development in this ongoing case.
Well, you know what, Noelle, when the Window Rock District Court Judge Carol Perry heard the for the injunction, she listened to both sides present, and the argument that was given by the council delegates, the ones that voted to place Speaker Nays on administrative leave because he had lost his good standing to be serving as Speaker because of the criminal charges that were filed against him by the special prosecutors, their argument was that they had actually tried talking with him, that they tried talking with him individually, in group, and that he just would not he would not step down and take care of those criminal charges that were facing him. And during the council meeting, you were there too, and when he was asked to speak in defense and as to why he shouldn't be placed on administrative leave, Noelle, were you at that session?
I remember the bill sponsor, Elton Joseph, were saying that he had, you know, that I can't remember if he tried to meet or had met with Nays to talk about this, and it didn't really go anywhere. But yeah, I remember that part of the discussion during the council session. Excuse me. And incidentally, Speaker Nays was at Chester Nez's funeral yesterday to present a letter of condolence from the tribal council to the family. So it was interesting to see him.
Well, that is interesting because he hasn't been at any of the council meetings. He hasn't been at the NABIC and IT committee meetings, and
right.
He's still a council delegate. And under the law, though, if he continues to be absent from council and committee meetings, he's putting himself in a position where he could actually be removed.
Right. Yeah,
I'm not sure,
I noticed,
you know, people know about that.
Mhm. Well, yeah, I could see that happening because he's not representing his constituents, which, you know, voted to place him in office. And incidentally, I noticed that he's the prime sponsor for a couple pieces of legislation that are on the proposed agenda for this Friday's NABIC IT committee. So I was curious if he'll show up to present those bills, or it'll go to the co-sponsor. And
that's what's been happening.
Mhm. Yeah. So, but like I said, I did see him yesterday. I didn't get a chance to talk to him because he was on the sitting on the west side of the church, and I was on the east side, and kind of towards the back.
Well, when the case was argued in front of Judge Carol Perry, that was one of the key arguments that was brought before her in defense of the council placing Speaker Nays on administrative leave, was that they had practiced the traditional way of resolving disputes, which was talking it out. Even the attorneys pointed at the council session when they removed him that every single council delegate had an opportunity to speak, including Speaker Nays. And they brought up that when Speaker Nays was asked to speak, that his defense was that he was very kind to all of them and that he gave them whatever they asked for. And that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing him, you know, in his defense. And I said, okay, you know, let's hear what he has to say, and that was it. And I was
mm-hmm.
thinking, well, you know, I don't think that's going to save you.
Yeah.
In fact, it's
right.
almost a bit like, you know, keep me in here, and I'll keep giving you whatever you want, you know, which is not good. You know, that's not what that position is for.
Mm-hmm. And I also remembered, you know, the members of the council saying, we're not removing you from your position as a delegate. We're just temporarily asking that you step away from your role as speaker, address the matter at hand, and then come back, you know. If you're saying you did no wrongdoing, the case should come out that way, you know. I remember them saying that to him, we're not stripping you of the title of council delegate. You will still carry that. Just, you know, step away from the speaker's office, take care of the matter, come back into into that. I mean, they weren't going to take away his title speaker either, you know. And then I thought that was pretty reasonable. But.
Well, he also is still receiving his payroll as speaker. He's also
right.
Been allowed to remain in the speaker's home. He gets all the benefits of being speaker. And so that was brought up. But the speaker's attorney argued, well, you know, it's not the matter of money or materialism. The speaker, he tried to bring up the traditional aspect and tried to argue that the speaker, you know, was the position of the people, which it is, but making it sound like the people had elected him to that position, but it's the council that elects the speaker. And when the council elected him speaker twice in a row, didn't have these criminal charges against him.
Right. He was in good standing as the law mandates when he was elected as speaker.
And so the latest update then is that the peacemaking option was given, and I had been hearing this from some of the council delegates. I've been asking them, are you willing to go into peacemaking? And they said, you know, we've already done that. We're moving on, and the speaker needs to move on. And that was one issue that also the speaker's attorney had difficulty in justifying as to why he should not have been removed. And he argued very well, but in the end, there was the council delegate's argument that
Hello.
Yes. Go ahead, Noelle. Go ahead, as you were. We just lost Marley's connection.
Oh,
go ahead.
Okay. I was like, she's gone.
Yeah. Just where did she go? But go ahead, as you were saying. She was speaking. That's true. But was there a point you wanted to make about that?
Not really. I mean, she was recapping what had occurred, and that was what I remembered as well. And then the line went out, and that's the call. I was like, hello?
Well, that's okay. As far as your section, your beat, where you're reporting, what are some of the I really am interested in wanting to know if the whole issue of, you know, protecting the environment and our resources, is that a topic of discussion?
Yes.
You know, the Navajo voters, are they discussing that at all? Because the reason why I ask that is simply because that whole section, the northwestern section of the Navajo Nation, you know, is well acquainted with uranium mining, and now we're talking about coal. And I just wondered if you know, basically, what's the buzz out there about that? Are they concerned about any of that?
I would say yes and no. I mean, you're going to, as with any society, you're going to have a difference in opinion. And I've been covering the matter of Navajo Mind, and they had the open house meetings for the draft environmental impact statement for the Four Corners Power Plant and Navajo Mine Energy Project. And there was a difference in opinions. Some people are saying, yes, we need to continue these projects because they sustain the economics of this area, not only, Navajo, but also Farmington's economy, Kirtland, Aztec, Bloomfield. And there were also voices of opposition saying that we need to look at the environmental impacts. Enough is enough. What you're taking from Mother Earth, it needs to stop. We got to think about trying to clean our air and our water quality. Where's the coal ash going? Why does something happen to that and it enters the water, the San Juan River? So they're in tune and they're discussing it. But as far as I guess the tying into the election cycle, I haven't really heard that side of the discussion yet. With our newspaper, what we're doing is we've kind of held off on covering the candidates that are out there campaigning until the deadline for the primary election, which is, you know, filing of the candidacy applications passed. And so now, like today, this morning, we talked about how we're going to try to do profiles on the 17 presidential candidates and then those who are running for council delegate positions from the chapters within the Northern Agency. So we're slowly getting into that election mode. And I think the reason behind that is because when we're a daily and the cycle of news I'm tackling, it changes each day. And secondly, the primary election is until August 26th, so there's a little bit of leeway for us to try to get our stuff together and out in when printing, you know.
Yeah, and of those 17, there's quite a few from, you know, the Shiprock area, correct?
Oh, yeah, we have. There's four candidates from Shiprock Chapter. You have Shiprock Chapter President Duane Chiliazzi. You have Council Delegate from Shiprock Chapter, Russell Begay. You have Donald Benally, who lives in Shiprock. And you have Daniel Smith, who also lives in Shiprock and is the head of the Navajo Corn Pollen organization or party. I don't know which one he prefers.
The Navajo Corn Party?
Yeah, Corn Pollen. Yeah. Navajo Corn Pollen, yeah.
Is it Corn Pollen? Okay.
I think it's Corn Pollen, if I remember rightly. But, yeah, we have those four running.
Yeah, Navajo Corn Pollen.
Yeah, so we have those four running. And
well, even in just that group, that's quite an age group, you know, difference.
Yeah, difference in ideas, difference in experiences, difference in ages. And if that alone is making the race interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. You were going to say something about Mr. Begay, Russell Begay?
Oh, no. I was going to say that he's the council delegate from there, and I think it's interesting that he's running for this position after, you know, a four-year term on the council. And it'll be interesting to see how the numbers shape up once the primary election passes and how which way the voters went on them.
And Mr. Chip Begay, is he from the also from New Mexico?
Yeah, he is from the Tohatchi chapter.
Mm,
and
okay.
Yeah, and then we also have Cal Nez, who's from Sinasti chapter, that's in the Northern Agency. And I don't have my list in front of me.
But that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's 17. That's quite a few. But, yeah,
yeah,
I was just really amazed that so many, you know, are from New Mexico. That's impressive.
It's a variety, you know. I kind of wish there were a little bit more of a female presence, but you have one, Carrie Martin. I think she's from the Western Agency, and she's, you know, throwing her hat in there, and let's see how she comes out, you know. Maybe, I mean, I'm sure this is going to be an experience to her. I don't know if she's considering a life in politics or whatnot, but this has to be definitely a learning thing.
Well, that was something that Marley and I kind of touched on in reference to Ms. Martin. She had told her Facebook friends that she wasn't able to make it to the last forum because she had full-time employment. And I thought, wow, how many people can relate to that? You know, so many people do not have the luxury of, you know, just being a full-time candidate. And, you know, they still have to, you know, work and provide for their families. So, you know, it's not an easy thing at all. And I remember back when the filing fee was like $200. And then just recently, like I think in, you know, this millennia, they changed it to $1,500. So,
right.
Yeah, so from what I understand, that was an effort to try to, you know, make sure that only the people who were sincere about running were the ones, you know, filing.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that's quite a jump in cost. But nonetheless, you know, there are most of these people, they do have full-time jobs, and they're trying to do this, you know, in addition to that. So, you know, more power to them. It's a difficult thing to do.
It is. And then also the behind-the-scenes stuff, how do you balance the family life with the campaigning? And then if you have a job tossed in there, that's three different hats you're wearing. And these events come up where, you know, you need to present your platform, you need to present your ideas, but how do you balance all that? And then if you live in Shiprock and, you know, four candidates are there, and let's say the debate takes place in Tuba City, you got to think, well, is it, you know, do I have the time to go over there and present myself and then come back and be ready for work at 8 a.m. the next day, you know? It's a lot of balancing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, for our listeners who may not know, the Navajo Nation is vast. It's about the size, you know, of West Virginia. So when, mm-hmm. you know, if you're an Eastern agency and you've got to go all the way, you know, to Western agency for, you know, an event, I mean, that's like going across the state. And,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, even sitting down and talking to my editors about how we're going to approach our coverage, we talked about, you know, trying to get photos of each of the candidates, and they were like, well, we can tell them, maybe they can come in, maybe we'll set 2 days aside for them to get their photos taken, we can ask them to come in. And I said, well, that's a good idea, but some of our presidential candidates are from like Lachie Chapter, or there's one from Shonto.
Chris Cheney,
and I think I want to say Del Sosi, but I'm not too sure about
that. Yes, Del Sosi is also from Lachie Chapter.
Okay. Yeah, and in those cases, you know, that's travel for them. That's a whole day to come here to Farmington to get a photo taken and then go back home, you know. And so I explained that to them, and it's like, this is the Navajo Nation's big.
Well, like in reference to campaigning, Marley, I know she's back. She can back me up on this. You know, oftentimes whoever's in the administration at the time, they have the advantage of oftentimes what we've seen happen is that they strongly ask, leaning more toward insist, of their division directors who they've appointed to contribute to their campaigns. Is that not right, Marley?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I just want to apologize to the listeners for getting dropped from the call here. But in the past, some of the executive office staff have reported that the current president will also asking their staff to pitch in. And it actually gets down to the point where, you know, this is where I've written on my blog and also talked to other people that there is a political appointee. And a political appointee is an individual who is selected by the president. And the it's selected by the president, politically appointed, and so that individual serves at the pleasure of the president. And if you want to keep your job, then you're going to want to do whatever you need to do to keep your job and please your vice president. So when the president will ask for your support, whether it's financial or being out there handing out his campaign material, he's going to be watching. And so this is kind of one of the perks that people, or unspoken perks or benefits of being in position and running for office. you're in that office and you're running. So, you know, you can ask for these certain things.
I think that also tends to be, you know, a point of a lot of frustration for many Navajo voters, because they're saying the simple point that, okay, we, the Navajo people, pay the appointed directors. And, you know, it's with tribal money that they get their salaries. And so when they take their money, part of their salary, to then, you know, contribute to the current administration's campaign, it's like the Navajo people are supporting that, you know, particular candidate again, whether they like it or not. And I've heard many times that people get very upset about that. It's not fair for the other candidates who do not have that option to go to any, you know, appointed directors and say, hey, you know, you have to contribute $2,000. I mean, that in the past, that's been a very common request, $2,000.
Now, do they have to report that on, like, their campaign finances, or no?
Well, I remember when you were talking about how you were doing that news story on the state candidates had filed financial awards that you called it. Hi, Noelle, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Remember you were talking about the state candidates?
Right. That was I remember talking about that.
The tribe doesn't require that anymore. I think they do, but now they don't.
Marley, your line's going in and out.
I don't know what it is. Where I'm sitting at. If it's coming in better now, I'm standing by the door.
I thought you might have taken off to space.
I think that's why I'm getting this kind of an echo, is because I don't have the reception. I think I'm sitting where my room is at, so I'll get better coverage.
I just kind of thought you might be recreating a space odyssey or something.
I know. This is crazy. We're here on the ridge with these phones, our cell phones. Thank goodness Sharon is on a line where she's on a landline, so she's coming across pretty clear here. So we're going to have to figure out how to get on a landline, and that'll be fun. Can you hear me all right, though, Noelle?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I was talking about the campaign finances. Go ahead.
Right. And I was gonna say. Well, I think my understanding of the state election cycle, the campaign finances reporting it is more frequent. Like, I think they have to file every so many days, so you know the public can know where they're getting their money to operate their campaigns from. But in doing my research so far about the upcoming election, I think the campaign financing for the tribe happens after the election. So after the primary of August 26th, the candidates will file their expense reports then. And then, you know, the two that go on to the general election won't file theirs until after the November 4th election. And by then, I don't know if maybe that's a way to deflect voters from kind of determining who they should vote for, as far as, you know, where their money's coming from. I don't know if that's one way to kind of to not have that happen, or maybe it's just because technology-wise, the access, like internet access, isn't, you know, everywhere on the reservation. So they think in that logical sense of, like, well, we're not up to speed as a non-reservation community is, so this is the easiest way for us to do it. So it's like the person can travel from point A to point B on that one time only.
I don't know. It would be interesting, though, to, I think, look at the history of how the tribe came up with reporting the campaign financing, now that I think about it.
Well, you know, the campaign financial statement was something that came from then Chairman and President Peterson Saw. And it was also under his administration that the Navajo Nation also received the ethics in government law. And that there was a clear recognition that there was a need for an ethics law regarding conflict of interest. And that conflict of interest law means that if you're an elected official or you are an individual in a position that can, that you make a decision regarding contracts, that you would have to let it be known that, hey, you know, this individual who we're entering into a contract with is my relative, or that business is actually I'm part owner, so I'm going to refuse it. And that's what the ethics and government law was about, to deal with conduct of elected officials, and that's where the financial statement also came in line. And it would be a good question to ask our candidates if they would sponsor legislation to have those very strict campaign laws.
Mm-hmm. So all this came after 1989 then?
Came after 1989. There was a lot of, that was a time period when there was a lot of political upheaval, but out of anything that is negative, there's always positive government policy. But I want to thank you, Noelle, for coming on to Navajo Politics on the Navajo Nation and speaking with us about your stories, especially the stories about the farming, your memories of being there, and the people that came to say their farewells to Navajo Coach Dr. Ned, and the update that you gave us regarding Speaker Nays of the Council. And I'm going to look forward to next week, and our listeners will too, to hear from what's happening in the northern part of the Navajo Reservation.
Sure, yeah. I'll give you a little preview. Friday, the city of Farmington will have their Miss Indian Farmington pageant, so I'm looking forward to covering that. As far as I know, there's four young Navajo within who've filed their applications and will be competing. And I asked today what the role of Miss Indian Farmington is, and that, like Miss Navajo Nation, they serve as an ambassador of the community. So I'll be covering that Friday evening at the Farmington Civic Center, and I'll let you know who wins and what they hopefully like to do during their year of service. But as always, Marley, it's a pleasure talking to you and being on the show and sharing some of the stories from the Northern Agency.
Well, I really appreciate it. Well, thank you. Yeah.
And for
our listeners, again, the call-in number is 347-989-0048. And I have a former scout, Numexi, was on the radio for several years. She also did a morning show for some of the Gallup radio stations. Her name is Sharon Mays. She's helping me with the board over here so that we can get the callers in. And just a few minutes ago, my phone dropped a call, and so I was disconnected, so she was able to pick that up. For the listeners, you've probably heard me talking about the case dealing with Speaker Nays and the council, and that's when the call got dropped. But we just got finished with speaking with Farmington Daily Times News reporter Noelle Smith. And once again, the phone number, if you'd like to call, is 347-989-0048. And Sharon will talk with you on the phone for a bit. Perhaps you want to make a comment, or maybe you don't want to make a comment yourself and would like her to present your comment to our listeners, and that's fine with us. We just need your first name and also what area you're calling from. We'd love to hear from you. So we're going to take a right now, and we'll be listening or watching for any callers, and that number again is 347-989-0048. And we'll also be hearing from Scout Independent Court Editor
and Navajo Times correspondent Bill Donovan leading this hour. Stay tuned. On the Navajo Nation. And a few minutes ago, we were speaking with Farmington Daily Times news reporter Noelle Smith. And any moment now, we should be hearing from Bill Donovan, which will be giving us an update of news around the Gallup area. He covers the Navajo Reservation for the Gallup Independent and also for the Navajo Times. But in the meantime, I'm going to be talking with my co-host, Sharon Mays, and she is, we're going to be talking about the windfall, the $564 million settlement, and it's being called a windfall by the Navajo Nation Council and President Skelly. And the Navajo Council approved that settlement on May 30th, and then the following week, President Skelly signed it during a signing ceremony at his office. And people that spoke, Council Delegate Lorenzo Curley was the head of a task force that the Navajo Council created for negotiations of the settlement. And there was also involved in the settlement was the Navajo Nation Justice Department, Attorney General Harrison Sosi, and also Deputy Attorney General Dana Bobroff. President Skelly presented Dana Bobroff with a beautiful Pendleton for her work. But during the comments that were being, or statements being made during the signing ceremony, one of them caught our attention, and this is from Skelly, quote, "I've been very conservative with our spending of money, but with this money coming in, I'll be a lot less conservative. We'll meet the needs of the people when you request funding." He was saying this to Speaker Pro Tem Lorenzo Bates, who was sitting at the table and as settlement agreement. The settlement agreement was made with the United States, and the settlement was of a lawsuit that the Navajo Nation Council ask the Attorney General to file against the United States for mismanagement of tribal trust funds and tribal resources. Specifically, the tribal trust funds were dealing with the funds that were being collected by the Bureau of Indian Affairs from oil and gas leasing and other resources along the eastern part of the reservation and throughout the Navajo. And Council Delegate Catherine Benally at one of the committee meetings reminded the Council that initially the Council had filed for $2 billion. They wanted a $2 billion settlement, but it was negotiated at $500 million. But I was talking with Sharon about the statement by President Shelley, and he was talking about that he's been very conservative with our spending of money. He was talking about how under another windfall, which came from the signing of the extension of a lease with Arizona Public Service Company for the Four Corners Power Plant, there was about 25 million that came in, but there was also some other settlements that came in. But at the time, President Shelley, in fact, the council was looking towards Washington, D.C., where Washington Congress was threatening to cut back on federal funds. And they were concerned because about maybe 60% of the Navajo Nation government's operating budget comes from the federal government in the form of contracts and grants. So the council and the president were thinking that if there's cutbacks, that's going to be less money that will be coming. So he wanted to save some of those funds, the windfall that was coming in. He's also cutting back on the council's appropriation. And so he was using the presidential line item veto for the set the people approved for the president, any president. So that's what he was talking about. And he reminded Speaker Pro Tem Lorenzo Bates, who also served as the Budget and Finance Committee Chair, about the many times that he did used his line item veto authority. But now he says, with his $554 million, that he's going to no longer be that conservative. And they went through a spending last week on the 30th, and they had a $5 million appropriation before this. That $5 million was going to the 100%. But that increase, that jumped from $5 million to $19 million. They added on an additional $1 million for the veterans for financial assistance, $3 million for college students and high school students for summer employment. And then they tacked on an additional $10 million for the 110 chapters. The 110 chapters are receiving $15 million. I'm a bit concerned because it seems that the spending frenzy has started. What do you
think? Well, I wanted to share with you, Marley, that that particular settlement actually has a nickname here in Window Rock. It's called the 554. That's something you don't hear too often, giving a settlement a nickname. But when people have been referring to it, the first thing, you know, that comes to mind and the things that people are saying is, why are they on such a tear to spend this money, and why don't they use it to replenish the trust funds that they waived the laws for so that they could spend the trust fund money? There's a lot of it's really been kind of touching, actually, that people, you know, they don't want this money spent immediately. What they want is they want the money to be saved. They want it to be put back into the trust funds. And I think people have been surprised at, you know, it's the election year, and couple of people that I spoke to here in Wonder Rock also expressed the opinion that they wish that this particular settlement had come next year and not this year, which is an election year. And it seems like, you know, election years do have a tendency to spur on a feeding frenzy, a spending frenzy. And then that's kind of how a lot of people here are thinking, that it feels like. It's like, you know, we're all just trying to grab everything all at once instead of what happened to, you know, saving for a rainy day, what happened to saving for our grandchildren and you know, our great-grandchildren. So it's been a very frustrating thing to hear about all that. Marlene?
Well, on it was Monday. There's a task force that's been put together by the Navajo Nation Council.
Okay, I'm not sure if our listeners were able to hear us, but I was at a meeting on Monday, and there was a task force meeting that was talking about the capital improvement funding options. And these options for funding capital improvement projects, and it's an energy 5-year plan, would be the first year that the capital, the funding would be at about 100 and, let's see here, okay. I'm trying to look at my notes, both, and I just dropped some papers, and I don't know where they went. Oh, okay, Sharon has my papers here. But I did some stories about this 5-year plan. And people need to understand that the 5-year plan is part of a requirement for our elected officials. When I say are, I mean Navajo Nation Council, President, Vice President. And the funding, this 5-year plan, they had to approve it before they could use the interest from the permanent trust fund. The balance of the permanent trust fund right now is, from what I heard at this meeting, $1.4 billion. So it's generating a huge amount of interest. That's what the council can begin to use once they approve a 5-year plan. And they did approve a 5-year plan. And I thought it was interesting at the time when they approved the 5-year plan that the plan was approved without any kind of funding. Especially when the first-year funding for the CIP plan was estimated at $142.9 million. That's the first year. And the second year, they're estimating would be about the same. But they're only dealing right now with the first year. And so at this meeting, they were talking about what you were just talking about, Sharon, about the set-asides. But they were talking about using those set-asides as part of the collateral to borrow money to fund this $142.9 million for capital improvement projects. And these are for the 110 chapters. But then from the discussion, I heard that not all the chapters had projects that they had turned in. So they're looking at the second year for all of the 110 chapters to have projects. And these projects have to be what they call shovel-ready, which means that they're all set to go. But then I heard some of the task force members talking about how would a portion of this funding, this first-year funding of $142.9 million be used for planning and blueprints? So if something, a project is shovel-ready, it shouldn't need to be funded for development or planning. But anyway, they actually, one of the options that was brought to the task force was actually to use 100% of the set-asides. And 100% of the set-asides is $58.3 million. That's annually. And for our listeners that don't understand what set-asides are, under Navajo law, the council, prior councils, agreed that there would be a certain percentage of the total revenues. These are whatever is generated by the tribal resources, coal, oil, gas, and they would set that aside. So like for the permanent trust fund, since the projected revenue for this year, 2015, is at $172.7 million, the permanent trust fund, a portion that the permanent trust fund would receive would be about $27.7 million. And then there's a certain amount that goes to the land acquisition fund, and that would be $4.6 million. There's also a veterans trust fund, and that would receive $9.2 million. There's also a trust fund for capital outlay match. These are matching funds for any kind of capital outlay, and that's at $2 million. That's just a flat $2 million. The historical trust fund receives a flat $1.5 million. The higher education trust fund received $11.2 million, and the water rights trust fund received $2 million. And so that adds up to $58.3 million. And the option that was presented to them for borrowing funds to cover the $142.9 million was to use that as leverage. And that would be, they would have to cover the debt service, which is the loan payment. And they're estimating the loan payment would be at, let's see, they were saying about one, they could fund up to $79 million. And so they would have to fund a total of $142.9 million. So to repay that annually for 7 years, that would, you know, we're talking about, you know, I'm trying to listen to all of this and as the accountants are talking about it. And the amount that they would have to keep paying back would be reduced over the years. So if they took 100%, they wouldn't have to pay back. The loan payment would be a lot smaller. But then, you know, if they take 50% of the set aside, that would be $29.1 million. And then they estimated at 25% of the set aside, and that would be $14.6 million that could be used to pay back the loan. And in all of this, so when you're talking about using, you know, increasing the amount for the $554 million, they're not thinking about increasing it. They're thinking about decreasing it. And they're also talking, and if they're going to go ahead with this plan, they would have to rescind prior resolutions, and they would have to change Navajo law.
So this is what I don't understand, and many people are very confused about, is why is it being termed a windfall when... After everything that you've just said, I think that's what makes so many people nervous and upset. You know, it's like it's, you know, this is a chance to replenish things that have been spent before that really shouldn't have been spent, you know, like with the trust funds and when they were waiving those, you know, those laws in reference to those.
Well, that was a concern that was shared by the council. After they found out that the investment committee had the authority to go ahead and use a portion of the set-asides. And one of the set-asides that they used was the scholarships and veterans. And those were used for a loan for building the failing Twin Arrows Casino and Resort. And so this funding, the people... And that was one thing that I had brought up when I was at the press conference or at the signing ceremony. They didn't have a question and answer period, and so I just asked the president and speaker pro tem if they were going to be having any public hearings or how are the Navajo people supposed to get involved on how the $554 million would be used. And I was told by President Shelley that my question was premature. And they were using the term investment plan, not expenditure plan. But it's the same.
Interesting, because that, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another, that's also been another concern is, all right, if they're going to spend it, do we get a say-so? Do we even get to, you know, present anything or you know, have any, our voice heard at all in how this money, how this windfall, excuse me, is going to be spent? And that's the Navajo people talking, Navajo voters.
During the meeting on Monday, that was actually one of the concerns or issues that was brought up as to would time allow for a public hearing or public comments from the people on how they would want to see the $554 million used. So that's finally coming into the discussion, but from the way that it was said, it seems like we're not going to be able to do that. We need to find an option to allow the people to make their comments, or what they usually say is, well, we were voted to represent the people. The people voted us in to make decisions, so let's make the decision.
Wow. So during that discussion, you know, wow. During that discussion, was there also not the point brought up about just giving everybody a bite of this or a piece of it per capita, you know, for every enrolled Navajo? Did that discussion come up?
Well, it wasn't discussed at all, no. They're looking at funding these capital improvement projects. And these capital improvement projects, I had put it out on my blog, listed all of the projects that are being proposed from the 110 chapters. And included in those 110 chapters is also the judicial public safety centers, the prisons and courthouses that are also under there. And so those are some of the projects. But I'll try to repost that and so that people can see what they're trying to fund. A lot of the funding for the capital improvement projects, if I recall, were for electrical lines or water lines. But at this point, I wish that there was some type of option for people to, or for our Navajo Nation to invest in alternative energy. There's, utility bills are just huge. These are basic needs of the people. And you have high unemployment, 45% or 50%. And so there should be a way for to help the people, and that would be to provide alternative energy to them so that it could reduce their utility bills. Navajo Housing Authority, why aren't they building homes that are what is energy efficient? Real energy efficient homes. They're building them everywhere else, but here on the Navajo Reservation, where we built our homes, our original homes are actually energy efficient. You go into a hold-on, and it's nice and cool in the summer, and in the winter, it stays warm. And that was such a simple home. It was beautiful. It was round. It helped us mentally, spiritually, and physically. And there are homes that are being built like that. And there are actually, Arizona Public Service Company takes advantage of solar energy. They have panels up on top of their business headquarters. A lot of corporations have gone into solar for their buildings. And so is alternative energy, are these new buildings, these government buildings that they're using, are they using that type of engineering? That should be a mandate.
I agree. The closest solar panels that I see every day is at the Seihotso Medical Center out front. They have those solar panels, and it just seems like everything changed. You know, you were talking about living in the traditional hogans. Everything changed when we went from living in a circle to living in boxes and, you know, rectangles. You know, and you're right. Why are we not looking at more energy-efficient ways to help people? Because power bills are just off the charts, especially out here on, you know, the Navajo Nation. And it's one of the greatest needs. We're talking about the basic need of just staying warm in the winter and keeping cool in the summer. And so many of our tribal people do not have electrical lines. They do not have water. I mean, these are just basic needs that people need to live a decent life. And how many times do people cry out for that? And I think that was one of the things that was so upsetting to so many people, because of they want to see that energy efficient methods used in homes now, so that they're not having to work 2-3, you know. I know one lady, she works 4 jobs just so she can pay her bill in the winter time. And, you know, how long can a human being put up with that? How long can they sustain that, working 4 jobs all their life?
Well, that goes back to the homes and how they're going, how they should be built energy efficient, because it would certainly allow people to use less wood if they're using a wood-burning stove out in those areas where they don't have any type of hookup. But if with the alternative energy, and I keep hearing this from the council, well, they don't, it doesn't generate enough electricity, it's not powerful enough, and, you know, why should we go into that? And I think to myself, are they talking about small-scale energy-efficient homes, or are they talking about a way to make a profit off of alternative energy? Because government should not be in business to be in business, if you know what I mean, to make a profit. They're there to provide services to the people. And that's where this whole idea of public service needs to be talked about. It needs to be out there every single day. These elected officials that are in office, they need to understand their public service, and that from that viewpoint, they need to understand they need to provide services instead of, well, you know, we need revenues to provide services. And it's like, where are the services? 10 years ago, I asked the auditor again, how much of the total operating budget, which is now projected at, what did I say, 100 and oh, geez. Here we are. Okay, yeah. For 2015, it's at $172.7 million. That's our budget for the am I still on? Mm-hmm. Hello? Okay. Well, anyway, that's the budget for 2015. And so 15% of that goes to direct services to the people. But then I hear the argument, well, actually, you know, What about the people that are out there, you know, providing those services, the salaries that are being paid, and, you know, what about, and they, so they want to get into these details. But I'm talking about actual services, helping individuals with the utilities so that they're not working 4 jobs, so that they can use some of the funding to get their children's school clothing. What percentage of that $554 million could go to the school clothing program? I haven't heard about the school clothing program for years or how it's budgeted, but until recently when I found out that there was a there's a possibility that the heating program and some other services are going to be returned to the Department of Family Services within the Division of Social Services, and that the Department of Self-Reliance will now become a program that those services are over to the Department of Family Services. And how much is that going to cost? Or what's happening? And what's the reason for that? And how is this information get out to the people that use these services? And this is during election year, I haven't heard anything from the president's office about this, letting people know, and he's out there, that these services are moving to a different department and where they're going to be at. We're talking about homes. If you come to Winterlock, you have to figure out where some of the offices are now. They keep moving because the 2 administration buildings are still closed. And they also closed another department which was dealing with natural, I think it was the Fish and Wildlife. Their building was closed. And these are providing services. They sell permits, fishing permits. They deal with picnic areas. These are basic services, and they're closed, and now they're located in, I don't even remember where they're located. Yeah, you know, and I'm here in Winter Rock. And so when people come from outside of Winter Rock to do business in Winter Rock, you know, I don't know what they're met with, really. I know that if they even have to use the bathroom, there's signs all over the place that say for not for public use. And these are Navajo government buildings that are paid for by the people.
I think that's a good question because, you know, we found out that, what is it, 80% of the budget is spent alone just in Winter Rock. And, you know, when you're talking about services to the people, it's like everything is run here in this small town and, you know, with all the government services. And it's a very frustrating thing because there are people in outlying areas that are waiting for decades. I mean, how many stories have you covered, Marley, about, you know, different areas of the Navajo Nation that they are waiting for, you know, services that they have requested decades before? And I think that's a lot of frustration that the Navajo people have with politicians. And they have a very short fuse when, you know, they're listening to the candidate's campaign because the need is so great, but they are looking for that person that's going to help to fill, you know, to get those needs fulfilled for the people. And who is that person going to be? That's what I keep hearing here in Winter Rock. Who is it going to be? That caller has just dropped. That's okay, but you can try again. We're coming up. The end of the program is coming very soon, but we are hoping to get Marley back on the air. But that goes back to, again, having this great need for all the members of the Navajo Nation. And there is a big debate about, okay, how do we fulfill these needs and how do we protect Mother Earth in the meantime? And it's really, really something that people are looking at these candidates very detailed, like unlike anything I've seen before or in history, because they really want to know who is going to protect the earth, who is going to provide the needs for the people, yet, you know, not spend every single penny that the Navajo Nation has and have that security net for the generations to come. Who is that person going to be?
Hello, this is Marley again. I wanted to say that there was a, at that meeting on Monday, the task force is going to be meeting at 9 a.m. on Friday, the 13th, before the NABIC ESIC committee. They're going to be meeting in the council chambers. So if you're really interested in how your $554 million will be used, show up at the meeting and hear what they have to say.
554, people. Remember that. Yes, that's...
Yes, remember 554. Remember that number.
I'm really happy that Karen is here with me. And I had wanted to hear from a lot of our callers, and we're going to keep playing with our board here, the Blog Talk radio board. We have this board here. Maybe I should take a picture of it so our viewers can see it, and I'll post it on Facebook. But it's a place where we can listen to our listeners. And we're going to see if we can. Okay. I guess that listener is gone now, but we're going to. Next week, we'd like you to tune in. And the number next week, again, is twice the sound. Please call us. It's at 347-989-0048. And that number, again, is
347-989-0048.
48.
Yeah,
okay. I just heard a voice. That's it. I have 90 seconds before the show is over. So, tune in, folks, next Wednesday, and if you have topics for us, find us on Politics on the Navajo Nation, and give us some ideas or guests that you would like to hear from, or even know something about the show.
Okay, we're looking for our outro.
You're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. This evening we have a guest, Mr. Robert Carr, calling in from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Albuquerque, New Mexico, da Janine Adi.